It's a threat of freedom of speech for the majority in Venezuela that lies behind the campaign in the West on behalf of the corrupt RCTV. The challenge for the rest of us is to lift this subjugated knowledge from out of the underground and take it to ordinary people. We need to make haste. Liberal democracy is moving to a form of corporate dictatorship. This is an historic shift, and the media must not be allowed to be its facade, but itself made into a popular, burning issue and subjected to direct action. That great whistleblower, Tom Paine, warned that if the majority of the people were denied the truth and the ideas of truth, it was time to storm what he called the Bastille of words. That time is now. Thank you.
Journalist and filmmaker John Pilger speaking in June in Chicago. Thanks to Matrix FM in Wellington, New Zealand for that audio. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
Let me take you back to 1913, to Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, where the miners are having a big Christmas ball. I'll take you through a door and up a high stairs. Singing and dancing is heard everywhere. Before you know it, you're friends with us all. And you're dancing around and around in the hall. You ask about work and you ask about pay. They'll tell you they make less than a dollar a day. Working their copper claims, risking their lives. So it's fun to spend Christmas with children and wives. Little girl sits down by the Christmas tree lights to play the piano, so you gotta keep quiet. To hear all this fun, you would not realize that the copper boss thug men are milling. Copper boss thugs stick their heads in the door. One of them screams and he yells, there's a fire. Lady, she hollers, there's no such a thing. Keep on with your party, there's no such a thing. Some people rush and it's only a few. It's just the thugs and the scabs fooling you. Man grabbed his daughter and he carried her down. But the thugs held the door and he could not get out. Then others rushed, 100 or more. But most everybody remained on the floor. The scabs, they laughed their murderous joke. And the children were smothered on the stairs by the door. Such a terrible sight I never did see. We took our children back up to their tree. The gun thugs, they laughed at their murderous spree. And the children that died there was 73. The piano played a slow funeral tune. The night was lit up by a cold Christmas moon. The parents, they cried, and the miners, they moaned. See what your greed for money has done.
David Rovics, The Massacre of 1913. I never learned about that and the many incidents like that in my high school American history class. Did you? I learned how the 1920s were an era of great prosperity. Is that what you learned? I didn't learn that the 20s were also an era of widespread poverty, with millions living below the official poverty line of $2,000 per year per family, very much like the present time. Why aren't we taught this in school? In the conclusion of the program, I'm going to read another installment from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, where he describes how the history textbooks were deliberately rewritten to serve an ideology and an agenda, just a couple of years after the miners' children were murdered. What was the story they wanted American school children to learn? One of the core American myths within the propaganda system is the conflation of democracy and freedom with capitalism. Here's another extended clip from Dr. Michael Parenti, who will set that up.
You know, globalization has been treated by its proponents as a natural, inevitable process. First, we had local economies, then they naturally became regional economies, and then national, and then international, and now one big global economy. It just happens that way. In fact, there's nothing inevitable about it, and there's certainly nothing natural about it. Globalization is being forced upon us through a series of secretive international trade agreements. Globalization really, when you look at it historically in a centuries-old context, is a future variant of imperialism. Imperialism is that system in which the leading dominant elements in one country expropriate the land, the labor, the resources, the capital of other peoples and other countries. And imperialism itself is an expansionist form of capitalism. Now, I want to make some critical comments about capitalism, even though we're in a Presbyterian church. I just think any mention of capitalism immediately evokes or induces some people to lapse into sentimentality and bathos. All our lives, we've heard about the valiant little entrepreneur who markets a new idea, who creates jobs. It's usually given in that kind of sentimental sing-song voice. Performs a valuable service. The mom-and-pop stores that contribute to the community and the economy. Okay, I'm not talking about them, okay? I'm talking about the other 90% of the wealth in this world. I'm talking about the giant financial institutions, the giant transnational corporations that control the lion's share of the world's worth, that control the populations and the power of nations. You can't talk about globalization and imperialism without talking about capitalism, although some people manage to do it and try to do that all the time. We're taught a few things about capitalism. We're taught that it's a system that works. It's a system that has brought us prosperity. We've heard that all our lives. Now, I'm going to try to convince you otherwise, and I'm going to do it in 2 minutes. Okay? It's very simple. Almost the entire world is capitalist. And almost the entire world is poor. Capitalist Indonesia is miserably poor and getting poorer. Capitalist India is miserably poor and getting poorer. So with capitalist Thailand and capitalist Nigeria, and capitalist El Salvador, and Haiti, and Mexico, and Brazil, and Argentina, and capitalist Russia, and Poland, and Bulgaria, with all the privatization and deregulation and free market coming in. Poverty, poverty, increase in crime, increase in desperation, increase in misery, increase in homelessness, increase in suicides. It's capitalism at work, moving in. Now, not everyone suffers. The capitalists in these countries are doing quite well. These countries are getting poorer as the giant corporations move in and get richer. More and more so-called free market, which is really monopoly market. It's a free market if you've got money. It's a market that works for those who have money. These countries are getting poorer because the people are being driven off the lands by the giant corporations. They create business zones. You can go to places, islands in the Philippines, where people have had beautiful communities for since time immemorial. They fish. They have their houses. In the community, they have their orchards, they have their vineyards and whatever, the farms. And the giant companies come in with some bogus claim to the land, drive them all off it, and clear cut the wood that's on there and turn it into a wasteland, since it's tropical topsoil. It can't survive clear cutting. And these people are driven off into the shanty towns. And you get a record in the Philippines, the gross national product has gone up because this company has come in and made all these sales on the timber. Meanwhile, thousands and thousands of lives are utterly destroyed. And the people go into the cities and they find new work opportunities under the free market capitalism, prostitution and drugs and beggary, all sorts of new things that didn't exist in their lives before. So those business zones make people poorer. The corporations go in and they displace and they wipe out domestic production and domestic businesses by dumping and underselling. That makes people poorer. The corporations go in, they force cutbacks in human services, education, health, and housing as the country develops a heavier and heavier debt structure, as the IMF does its structural adjustment programs, imposing conditions of lowered spending and lowered consumption. They consume less, they've got to produce more to help pay this debt, a debt that becomes soon unpayable because it accumulates and compounds. That makes people poorer. The corporation forced down prices of non-renewable resources, go in and plunder the land, the earth, to get those natural resources out, underpaying whatever production the people do produce and whatever they put on the international market is underpaid through monopoly control of those markets. That makes people poorer. So we've solved the mystery. Look, I get it in a little bit more than 2 minutes. We've solved the mystery, though, why over the past half century financial investment has increased, profits have increased, wealth has increased, but so has poverty. Because wealth and poverty don't just live together in unfortunate juxtaposition. We always hear that too, don't we? Isn't it terrible? So much wealth next to so much poverty. What a shame. Wouldn't it be nice if these people gave a little bit more to these people? Well, they're not just there so much shamefully in contrast. They're there in a dynamic interrelationship because it's wealth that creates poverty. The corporations don't go into the third world to start affirmative action programs, to abolish poverty, to uplift these little brown and black and yellow people to the ways of the wise white man. They don't go in to do that. Or they actually talk about doing that. They don't go in to help the poor. They go in to help themselves. And that's what they do. Well, okay, Parenti, capitalism doesn't work so well for the common people in those third world countries, but it has given us a good standard of living. Let's now look at that. Will you give me 3 minutes to disabuse you of that myth that some of you I won't ask for a show of hands, but some of you have held all your life. Let's look at our own North American society. Let's put aside the massive inequalities. Let's put aside the tens of millions who struggle from hand to mouth. Let's put aside the many who call themselves middle class but who live without any real economic security. Let's put aside the desperate ones at the very bottom. Let's put aside the attacks and impoverishment on the public sector and the destruction of a livable environment. Let's just put all that aside for a minute, those little things. And let's accept the idea that we live in great material abundance, and compared to much of the world, we do. Many of us in Canada and the United States live very well indeed. That's why the victims of capitalism, we always hear about the victims of communism wanting to flee communism. Nothing's ever been said about the victims of capitalism. I come from a family of victims of capitalism. My grandparents, both families, came from southern Italy, grinding, terrible poverty. They were victims of capitalism. They came over here to be victims of capitalism again, but a little less so. And that's what happens. So let's accept this idea of great material abundance. But it wasn't capitalism that gave us a good standard of living. It was the democratic struggle against corporate capitalism that did it. I mean, why don't Canadians work for 15 cents an hour as people in Haiti and Indonesia do? Is it because you're just so much more self-respecting, you just wouldn't do that? Or is it because you're at a level of democratic class struggle, a historical level that has advanced to a more favorable level? You know, North Americans used to work for starvation and subsistence wages. In 1900, Canada and the United States and the Netherlands and Denmark and France and other countries that are today considered very prosperous capitalist countries, Western industrial countries, they don't want to use the word capitalism as much. They just don't want you to think about capitalism. They were all third world nations almost a half a century before the term was invented. Child labor was widespread. Poverty was widespread. Unemployment, underemployment, 14-hour workdays, no social services to speak of except an occasional church or charity, no social benefits, typhoid epidemics in Philadelphia and Baltimore, tuberculosis, other diseases of poverty, no public housing or public health services to speak of, very little public education, no public libraries, hardly. Advances came not with capitalism. Capitalism was reigning. Capitalism, the capitalist class, the Mellons, the Morgans, the Rockefellers, the Harringtons, all these people, they were making it in there. Advances came when we made certain democratic victories. The 8-hour day, the end of child labor, worker safety, the right to labor unions and the collective bargaining, public health programs, disability insurance, old age pensions. These are things that we have been fighting for, still inadequate, still insufficient, still not universal, and yet these things, as incomplete as they are, they are still under siege by the same people who fought against those things. It wasn't capitalism that brought these advances, it was democracy. It was the people acting as the active social agents of their own lives, fighting and struggling for those things. And the capitalists, the rich bankers, the merchant class, the corporate class, the slaveholders, they all fought against democracy. They fought against political democracy as well as economic democracy. In the United States, that class fought against the elimination of property qualifications for voters and office holders. They fought against universal suffrage for working men. They fought against suffrage for women. They fought against the abolition of slavery and Jim Crow. They fought against honest elections, and they're still doing a very good job of that in Florida. They fought against Democratic ballot access. They fought against proportional representation, campaign finance reform, civil liberties, and they're still fighting against these things. They're fighting against every bit of political democracy and every bit of economic democracy that benefits the people. So why do you credit the capitalists with the gains that you made against the capitalists?
Dr. Michael Parenti, that clip from a 2002 talk given in Vancouver, B.C. We'll continue with our serial reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. We've been reading from Chapter 17, getting towards the end of the book. The title of that chapter is The Politics of Schooling. In the section I read last week, Gatto had written, quote, "Global entrepreneurs such as John D. Rockefeller Sr. and Andrew Carnegie found natural selection to be a perfect explanation for their laissez-faire economic principles. To Rockefeller, for instance, quote, the growth of large business is merely survival of the fittest. Savage business practices aren't evil, merely the working out of a law of nature and a law of God, close quote. According to Herbert Spencer, nothing escaped evolution's power. Every single organism or institution evolved, religions evolved, economies evolved. Evolution exposed democratic theory for the childish fantasy it really was." This quote suggests that at the heart of our social order is the necessity to put across a certain economic vision, one which is indeed the opposite of democracy, yet to have it lauded and embraced by the mass of the population as the path to freedom. We continue now with Chapter 17, as Gatto writes, "One of the finest academic studies of the origins of our time and its economic antecedents is Karl Polanyi's The Great Transformation. Published in 1944, it has been kept in print ever since. Polanyi's explosive conclusion states unflinchingly that we must now become, quote, resigned to the reality of the end of our liberty, close quote. How did he figure this out in 1944? By extrapolation from the track of modern history, which he regarded as unidirectional, and which teaches us that the end of liberty is a, quote, necessary evil. At the end of his book, Polanyi offers a perfect public relations solution to the anguish of losing freedom. By cleverly redefining the word to mean, quote, a collective thing, the loss of liberty will not hurt so much, he says. This kind of therapeutic newspeak has been a dominant element in national life for most of the 20th century, infecting every schoolroom. Professional manipulation of attitudes by control of language and images, once the stock in trade of a few men of bad character, like Edward L. Bernays, is a common tool of leadership. Polanyi's wish for us to be deluded in our own best interests has become the daily bread of everyone. Walter Lippmann's disrespect for commonality became official government policy during the Franklin Delano Roosevelt years and has remained so ever since. One way to chart the transformation is through the taxing power, which should be seen as a way to diminish individual choice in favor of bureaucratic choice. Prior to 1947, less than 1/20th of an average income went for taxes. In 2004, the fraction is much larger, much larger. Some powerful dynamic now works to take care of us as if we were permanent children. Think of forced institutional schooling as the surgery where our dependency implants are first installed. The political basis for the schools we have and for the politics of schooling we struggle against was laid down just before the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk. Where we are today is a kind of intertidal stage, in which the last remnants of the historic American tradition are being set aside to make way for a thoroughly planned global economy and society, an economy apparently intended to be scientifically managed by a professional class of technicians at the bottom, a professional proletariat of rootless, well-paid men and women in the middle, and a small group, no more than 1%, of knowledgeable managers at the top. To get to where we got, public imagination had to be manufactured from command centers. But how was this managed? In 1914, Andrew Carnegie, spiritual leader of the original band of hard-nosed dreamers, gained influence over the Federal Council of Churches by extending heavy subsidies to its operations. And in 1918, Carnegie endowed a meeting in London of the American Historical Association, where an agreement was made to rewrite American history in the interests of social efficiency. Not all leaders were of a single mind, of course. History isn't that simple. Beatrice Webb, for instance, declined to accept financial aid from Carnegie on her visit, calling him a reptile behind his back. The highborn Mrs. Webb saw through Carnegie's pretensions, right into the merchant ledger of his tradesman's soul. But enough were of a single mind, it made no practical difference. On July 4, 1919, the London Times carried a long account reporting favorably on the propaganda hydra growing in the United States, without identifying the hand of Carnegie in its fashioning. According to the paper, men, quote, trained in the arts of creating public goodwill and of swaying public opinion, unquote, were broadcasting an agenda which aimed first at mobilizing world public opinion and then controlling it. The end of all this effort was already determined, said the Times, world government. As the newspaper set down the specifics in 1919, propaganda was the fuel to drive societies away from their past. Quote, efficiently organized propaganda should mobilize the press, the church, the stage, and the cinema. Press into active service the whole educational systems of both countries, the homes, the universities, public and high schools, and primary schools. Histories should be revised. New books should be added particularly to the primary schools. Close quote. The same issue of the London Times carried a signed article by Owen Wister, famous author of the best-selling novel, The Virginian. Wister was then on the Carnegie payroll. He pulled no punches, informing upscale British readership, quote, a movement to correct the schoolbooks of the United States has been started, and it will go on, close quote. In March 1925, the Saturday Evening Post featured an article by a prominent Carnegie official who stated that to bring about the world Carnegie envisioned, quote, American labor will have to be reduced to the status of European labor, close quote. 10 years later, on December 19, 1935, the New York American carried a long article about what it referred to as, quote, a secret Carnegie endowment conference at the Westchester Country Club in Harrison, New York. 29 organizations attending each agreed to authorize a nationwide radio campaign managed and coordinated from behind the scenes, a campaign to commit the United States to a policy of internationalism. Let me just break in here. Gatto uses words such as internationalism in an unusual way. A way I'm certainly not used to using it. Normally, internationalism, in the way I understand it, refers to global working class solidarity beyond the borders of the nation state. Gatto is using the term to refer to relations between those nation states. Continuing. The group also agreed to present, quote, vigorous counteraction against those who opposed this country's entrance into the League of Nations. Pearl Harbor was only 6 years away, an international showcase for globalism without peer. Another strange usage of the word, I might add. Continuing. Soon after this conference, almost every school in the United States was provided with full-size color maps of the world and with League of Nations literature extolling the virtues of globalism. That's how it was done. That's how it's still done. Okay, I need to break in here. Gatto is a libertarian, and like many people that share his political perspective, they have a view that organizations such as the United Nations are exerting some type of global world government that somehow is at odds with national sovereignty. The reality is that organizations such as the United Nations have largely functioned as a policy arm of the United States establishment and its European allies. The organization that's really attacked national sovereignty in the sense of the ability of people within a nation to make their own laws is the World Trade Organization, which has put transnational corporate interests beyond the ability of national democracies to control their activities. Anyway, I find it really strange that it should be a bad thing that a school should have a full-size color map of the world, given especially how many people in this country have little idea about what's going on in the rest of the world, much to everyone's detriment. Anyway, continuing, Gatto says, universal schooling is a permeable medium. There need not be a conspiracy amongst its internal personnel to achieve astonishingly uniform results. Multiply this tactical victory thousands of times and you get where we are. Today we call the continuation of this particular strand of leveling multiculturalism, even though every particular culture it touches is degraded and insulted by the shallow veneer of universalism, which hides the politics of the thing. And another comment on Gatto's use of language. He always uses the term leveling in a negative connotation, such as bringing people down to the least common denominator and thus diminishing them. Within the left libertarian community, as opposed to the right libertarian community to which Gatto belongs, leveling is understood to be the egalitarian redistribution of resources and decision-making power from a hierarchy at the top to each person within the society. Continuing with Gatto. Early in the 20th century, official language, including official school language, became a deliberate systemic exercise in illusion. Governments have always lied, of course, but at the beginning of the 20th century, an accretion of psychological insights gathered from past epochs of magic, theology, philosophy, arts, warfare, rumor, and madness were collected, codified, and the conclusions sold to the leaders of political states, global corporations, and other powerful interests welded into a technology of professionalized dishonesty. Secrets of crowd behavior and the presumed instrumental wiring of human nature were made available to anyone with the price of admission. The newly official pragmatic philosophy became a kind of anti-morality, superior to any ethical code fashioned out of custom and philosophy. 400 years after Niccolò Machiavelli wrote his treatise on scientific deceit, Edward L. Bernays began to practice the scientific art of public deception, trading heavily on his uncle Sigmund Freud's notoriety. A decade earlier, Ivy Lee's publicity savvy had rescued the Rockefellers from their Ludlow Massacre disgrace. Public relations, as political science, was often running on the fast track. Bernays was only a solitary word magician at the time, of course. but he was in an ideal position to capitalize quickly upon his rhetorical talent and to set his stamp on the new science's future. In 1928, Bernays published two books in quick succession, which planted his flag in the dream terrain of the unconscious. The first, Crystallizing Public Opinion, and the second, Propaganda. Adolf Hitler is said to have displayed both on a table in his office under a poster-sized picture of Henry Ford. The New World was blazing a trail into an even newer world than it imagined. Both of Bernays' books argued that language could be used successfully to create new realities. Psychological science was so advanced, he claimed, it could substitute synthetic reality for natural reality. As urban society had successfully replaced our natural connection to birds, trees, and flowers with a substitute connection to billboards, cars, and bright lights. Crystallizing Public Opinion and Propaganda had much to say to the newly minted administrative classes burgeoning all over American schools and colleges. In Propaganda, Bernays redefined democratic society in the interests of the mass production economy. I've selected three short excerpts from Bernays' classic, which enriched him with corporate work in the 7 decades of life he had left after its publication. He died in 1995 at the age of 105. The first assertion of Propaganda was that common people had to be regimented and governed from behind the scenes. Here are Bernays' actual words, quote, "The need for invisible government has been increasingly demonstrated. The technical means have been invented and developed by which public opinion may be regimented." Close quote. The next important contention was that the critical pollution of language necessary to make this work was already in use. Quote, "We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. We are dominated by a relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public." Close quote. Finally, Bernays attempts to provide a so-called moral justification for proceeding as he suggests, quote, "The conscious manipulation of organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in a democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power in this country." Close quote. This attitude of manipulation, as an important component of, quote, democratic management, entered the urban factory school classroom in a big way at a time when psychology was taking over from academics as the tool of choice in America's German-inspired teacher training institutions. Bertrand Russell had been both a witness and an actor in the new climate of public deceits, which characterized the post-World War I epoch. When its first phase was complete, he wrote in The Impact of Science on Society, published in 1952, that the most important subject for the future would be mass psychology and propaganda studies, which would be rigidly confined to the governing class. The populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions were generated. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Magic, in one form or another, had always appealed to professional school authorities as the means to manage students. Horace Mann, as you know, dedicated his entire 6th report to a paean in phrase of phrenology, the, quote, "science of reading head bumps," and every major schoolman from Mann to G. Stanley Hall and John Dewey was a serious phrenologist, long after the craze had vanished from upper-class drawing rooms and salons. That should tell you something important about the inner itches of these men, I think. A quest for certainty in a confusing new land without rules, was as much the religion of our founding schoolmen as searching one's family for signs of reprobation had been for Puritans. But modern schoolmen needed a scientific cast over their religiosity, times having changed. Early educational psychologists scientized the practice of manipulation behind a common expression of modern pedagogy, motivation. Book after book advised pedagogues how to motivate charges with technical advice based on an underlying premise that young people did not want to learn and had to be tricked into it, a premise which on the face of common experience was absurd. As the significance of Bernays' arguments penetrated the high command of government and industry, so too did manipulation become sine qua non in classroom teaching, the standard by which teacher quality was measured. But the methods of Bernays or of educational psychologists like Dewey, Munsterberg, Judd, Hall, Cattell, Terman, Thorndike, Goddard, and Watson, which so radically transformed the shape of 20th century schooling, are about indoctrination strategies, building and using psychological tools to create compliant children. If nature hadn't cooperated by actually making empty children, then schooling would have to do the job. And yet, for what grand purpose children had to be emptied, not many knew. For those without religious training or ignorant of the evolutionary sciences, it made only the bleakest sort of sense. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. Between 1890 and 1930, the culture of big business took over the culture of public education, establishing scientific management and corporate style as the predominant imperative. Although linkages between business and education elites were complex, the goals and values of business established the rules by which both played. And while schools proved unwilling to dare influencing business, the reverse was far from true. Businessmen dominated the political movement in schools to abolish the system of local control through wards nearly universal at the end of the 19th century. Along with professionals, businessmen served disproportionately on new streamlined school boards. Business language permeated the corridors of school management. Businessmen and their wives were the political force behind Frobelian kindergartens, which removed young children from family influence. And they were behind vocational schooling, which left no romantic dreams for ordinary children. The National Association of Manufacturers, the National Civic Foundation, the Ad Council, the Business Roundtable, and other business-relevant private associations publicized the need for school change, told the public how children should act, what they should honor, what behaviors would be rewarded. A steadily lengthening school year led to an extended career ladder, specialization, and a credential-oriented society. School people were assigned the role of bringing about a conflict-free world by teaching indirectly that the preemption of work by corporations and professions, later by government, was right, proper, and scientific. The Irish historian and philosopher W.E.H. Leckie, in his History of European Rationalism, called Rationalism in Europe, predicted that temptations posed by a forced assemblage of children would prove in the end too strong to resist. Powerful interests would inevitably manipulate schooling to serve their own agendas. Quote, "The opinions of 99 persons out of every 100 are formed mainly by education, and the government can decide in whose hands the national education is to be placed, what subjects it is to comprise, and what principles it is to convey." Close quote. "If all paths of honor and wealth are monopolized," said Leckie, "the powerful motive of self-interest will be enough to bring most students to heel." Quote, "The simple fact of annexing certain penalties to the profession of particular opinions, and rewards to the profession of opposite opinions, while it will undoubtedly make many hypocrites, will also make many converts. Close quote. That from Rationalism in Europe, published in 1883. Once a system of reward and punishment is set up and broadcast by frequent public examples of its power in action, the nature of argument is almost predetermined. Although subjects of such a regimen may be entirely unconscious of the source of their opinions, once the doctrine of, quote, exclusive salvation for the cooperative and damnation for the critic is clearly established, rulers will never be seriously questioned, thought Lecky. By 1899, William H. Baldwin, president of the Long Island Railroad, descendant of the man for whom the Baldwin locomotive was named, demonstrated how well the school lesson had been learned and how forcible could be its application. Baldwin was a member of the Peabody, Rockefeller, Carnegie Southern Education Board, self-appointed to bring the benefits of Northern schooling to the war-ravaged South. Although in the beginning of its career, freed blacks were treated to the same type of rigorous, classically oriented schooling we would call liberal today, meaning one designed to liberate the judgment from prejudice and ignorance, as time passed, it began to seem impolitic to so treat blacks as equals. It alienated important elements in the Southern white community, who were more important fish for the Northern school net to land. Thus, a decision was made to jettison equality as a goal and make labor value the most important determinant of which way each group would be schooled. There is perhaps no more naked statement of the political uses of schooling on record than Baldwin's official word about, quote, the present problem of Negro education, unquote, delivered before Capon Springs Conference on Southern Education in 1899, quote, know that it is a crime for any teacher, white or black, to educate the Negro for positions which are not open to him, close quote. Important liberals like Edgar Gardner Murphy, whose descendants are still active in American schooling, and other leading progressive humanists hastened to agree with Baldwin. In David Tyack's analysis, these men sought to develop an applied technology of school decision-making similar to technologies of production and management, then transforming the bureaucratized corporate economy. This technology reflected evolutionary presuppositions, rooting its values in supposed evolutionary laws. Ideals could be hierarchically arranged and pinned down on a scale of races, classes, sexes, and historical stages grounded allegedly in nature itself. According to James Russell, for 30 years, Dean of Teachers College, the purpose was to equip teachers and administrators for, quote, missionary service. What we are looking to discover through building this new institution, said Russell, is the modern significance of the old doctrines of original sin and salvation by grace, to bring forth works meet for repentance, close quote. Teachers College, Stanford, Chicago, Johns Hopkins, Wisconsin, Michigan, Yale, etc., were the West Points of the Educational Trust, men like Elwood P. Cubberley, its generals. Cubberley, also writer and editor of Houghton Mifflin's Education Series, the largest and most successful set of professional books published for school people in the first half of the 20th century, legitimized by his influence the new reforms of vocational guidance, quote, junior high schools, hygiene programs, and more. The book series gave him great power to shape the new science of education, making him a fortune. Its effects on school management were vast. Cubberley wrote, quote, one bright child may easily be worth more to national life than thousands of low mentality, close quote. He taught influential schoolmen that genetic endowment explains success and failure in the social order, and taught thousands of politicians the same lesson as well. Cubberly was one of a small band of leaders who invented professional school administration as an occupation, and professional school administration created the tracking system so that different grades of evolutionary raw material could be processed in different ways. One of many innovations science and business efficiency seem to demand. In so doing, a strong class system possessing nearly the strength of a caste system was created, with important political implications for every American child. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Jean Anion, a professor at Rutgers, recently examined four major types of covert career preparation going on simultaneously in the school world, all traveling together under the label, quote, public education. All use state-certified school teachers, all share roughly common budgets, all lead to intensely political outcomes. In the first type of classroom, students are prepared for future wage labor that is mechanical and routine. Of course, neither students nor parents are told this, and almost certainly teachers are not consciously aware of it themselves. The training regimen is this. All work is done in sequential fashion, starting with simple tasks, working very slowly and progressing gradually to more difficult ones, but never to very difficult work. There is little decision-making or choice on the part of students. Much rote behavior is practiced. Teachers hardly ever explain why any particular work is assigned or how one piece of work connects to other assignments. When explanations are undertaken, they are shallow and platitudinous, quote, "You'll need this later in life." Teachers spend most of their day at school controlling the time and space of children and giving commands. In the second type of classroom, students are prepared for low-level bureaucratic work, work with little creative element to it, work which does not reward critical appraisals of management. Directions are followed just as in the first type of classroom, but those directions often call for some deductive thinking, offer some selection, and leave a little bit of room for student decision-making. The third type of classroom finds students being trained for work that requires them to be producers of artistic, intellectual, scientific, and other kinds of productive enterprise. Often children work creatively and independently here. Through this experience, children learn how to interpret and evaluate reality, how to become their own best critics and supporters. They are trained to be alone with themselves without a need for constant authority, intervention, and approval. The teacher controls this class through endless negotiation. Anion concludes, quote, "In their schooling, these children are acquiring symbolic capital. They are given opportunity to develop skills of linguistic, artistic, and scientific expression and creative elaboration of ideas in concrete form." Close quote. The fourth type of public school classroom trains students for ownership, leadership, and control. Every hot social issue is discussed. Students are urged to look at a point from all sides. A leader, after all, has to understand every possible shade of human nature in order to effectively mobilize, organize, or defeat any possible opponent. In this kind of schoolroom, bells are not used to begin and end periods. This classroom offers something none of the others do: knowledge of and practice in manipulating socially legitimated tools of systems analysis. Close quote. It strikes me as curious how far Anion's elite public school classroom number 4 still falls far short of the goals of elite private boarding schools. Almost as if the very best government schools are willing to offer only a weak approximation of the leadership style of St. Paul's or Groton. What fascinates me is the cold-blooded quality of this shortfall, because Grattan's expectations cost almost nothing to meet on a different playing field, say a homeschool setting or even in John Gatto's classroom. While the therapeutic community of psychologized public schooling is extremely expensive to maintain, virtually everyone could be educated the Grattan way for less money than the average public school costs. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Who governs? To what degree may rule be exercised arbitrarily? These are political questions of forced schooling. In a free society, contention is liberty's friend. Conflict extended indefinitely is our personal guarantee there will always be ways out of being suffocated by the will of another. In a free society, the power situation must always be kept fluid, even though there is a high price in inefficiency, instability, and frustration paid by the ruling group or coalition for that fluidity. As long as liberty is cherished beyond efficiency, the price will be paid. It is only a short leap to deduce the political crime of mass forced schooling. It amputates the argument and replaces it with engineered consensus. Once such a peacemaking apparatus is built, its interior drive to self-preservation and growth will organize its line and staff personnel around a single-minded logic of orthodoxy. But that orthodoxy will always be committed to the service of the economy, not to the interests of its nominal clientele. The New York Times of January 18, 2001, had this to say on page A22 about the economic politics of schooling, quote, "Education aid is distributed through at least 55 different formulas, so technical only a select few can pretend to understand them," close quote. What explains this? Accident? Stupidity? No, neither. Quote, "The school formulas are incomprehensible in order to disguise how the system really works," close quote. An explanation attributed by the Times to a, quote, "influential politician, otherwise unidentified." As schooling encroaches further and further into family and personal life, monopolizing the development of mind and character, children become human resources at the disposal of whatever form of governance is dominant at the moment. That confers a huge advantage on the leadership of the moment, allowing it to successfully reproduce itself, foreclosing the strength of its competitors. Schooling becomes what is the ultimate form of subsidy for corporate and status welfare, destroyer of the free market. Without opposition made possible by the education rather than schooling of children, a planetary management corporation is our certain destiny, and just as certain to be followed sometime after its birth by a dissolution into chaos, the fate of all empires. Our school tragedies are an early warning of something inherent in the laws of human thermodynamics. Chaos increases steadily in closed systems cut off from the outside. Overorganization precipitates disorganization. Where the developing consciousness of children cries out for jazz, what it gets instead is a scale exercise. And that's the conclusion of Chapter 17, The Politics of Schooling, of John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, a book which reflects 10 years of research by this former award-winning school teacher from New York City. You can learn more about Gatto's work and actually download this entire book for free online at his website, johntaylorgatto.com. And Gatto is GATTO.com. And you can download this and all previous episodes of the show, including all the readings of John Taylor Gatto, at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Yeah.